Hello and welcome to another news episode of BFRR, our Bitcoin, Fiat and Rock'n'Roll podcast that explores the intersection of traditional finance, digital assets and digital currencies and helps you understand how digital currencies and assets will evolve in the future. I'm co-host Jonas, and it is today again the end of the month, which means it is time for another news episode. And today I'm happy to be joined by our co-hosts Alex and Michi. Hi, you two.
Hi, Jonas.
Hello.
What do we discuss today? We discussed already in our last news episode that the stablecoin mania continued, and we have to say it again this month. The stablecoin mania continued also in June. Amongst others, we will discuss today that the US Senate passed the Genius Act, basically a very sophisticated piece of regulation. So we will basically discuss what it is and why it matters. We talk about Circle, who had a super successful IPO and also has now kind of a valuation that is very high and even comes close or even represents a valuation of big banking giants like Deutsche Bank. So we will disentangle if, you know, is this justified or not? Of course, no investment advice, the usual disclaimer. And we will also talk about JP Morgan, who launched a stablecoin-like construct on a permissionless blockchain, and will basically also debate like what it is, what it means, and why it is potentially very relevant. So you see, a super interesting month, and let's jump directly into it and start with a quick market update. So when we look into the whole crypto market, we are currently standing with a market capitalization of approximately $3.3 trillion, which is pretty much the same as at the beginning of the month. However, there was definitely some price volatility in there. It was an up and down, primarily due to political reasons. There was an escalation of the conflict between Iran and Israel, and also a subsequent ceasefire, which kind of de-escalated a little. So if we look then particularly at Bitcoin, we have seen a price development, a slight increase in the month from $105,000 to $107,000. But we also have seen in this month that the Bitcoin price fell below 100K and rebounded to 107 again, as I said, due to the discussed political developments. What I found very interesting again on Bitcoin in this month is again this topic of a Bitcoin reserve, or put differently, some companies that invested into Bitcoin or states or want to invest. In particular, I was pretty excited because I'm a football fan that Paris Saint-Germain, the football club, basically the winner of the Champions League, wants to build up a Bitcoin reserve, which I think is kind of first of its kind, if I'm not mistaken.
I think they also already have a fan token, right? I still remember the news that Messi, when he played there, received part of his salary in a fan token. So they have always been, let's say, crypto/token friendly in Paris.
Definitely. So if you compare other football clubs, it's definitely not a surprise that Paris did it, but still they are the first. So very interesting. And I think if I'm not mistaken, there are currently more than 240, I think, companies that invested into Bitcoin. So basically have Bitcoin on their balance sheet, which is kind of, I think, double the amount we had 1 or 2 months before. So we do see a very strong momentum of companies going now or entering this Bitcoin race as well from some kind of an asset allocation perspective. And besides companies, we've also seen an announcement that Pakistan as a country wants to launch a strategic Bitcoin reserve, similarly to the US. So also here, an interesting one. And last but not least, and again for me, another incredible milestone data point when it comes to the Bitcoin ETFs, that the BlackRock ETF IBIT reached 70 billion asset under management in another record time. It just took them 341 days, and this was 5 times faster than the previous record holder, GLD, with almost 1,700 days. So just another data point that institutional demand from the ETF side is still there, and this also continued in the month of June.
Well, what I find astonishing is also the difference between the US and Europe when you look at those products. And BlackRock has by now also issued a crypto ETP, ETN, I believe, in Europe, which has, I would have to check, let's say 300 million, so a couple of hundred million, which is, of course, significantly lower than what's happening in the US. And this is also true for other crypto ETPs in Europe. So there's a huge difference. I'm not sure whether it's because of the wrapper, because in Europe, you are not allowed to issue Bitcoin ETFs, right? You have to use a bit of a different wrapper which comes with different, let's say, regulatory or legal rights that you have as an owner. But I'm not sure if that can explain that huge difference. So I find it really surprising that the Europeans are so conservative, while in the US apparently there is a big hunger for crypto assets.
Maybe the mentality and the risk appetite also plays a role, right? We know that Europe is often rather conservative, as you said, and risk averse. So we always just, or often just check what is going on in the US and maybe do this a few years later. But I agree, Alex, while US, there are, every record is currently being broken. In the Europe, there's at least, it seems to be some demand, but not really more for most of the products. When we now just turn briefly to Ethereum, I mean, it's basically discussed pretty quickly that it's kind of the similar level as beginning of the month, which is around $2,400. So there were some key news on a restructuring of the Ethereum Foundation in the last month, which I think was the most relevant news around Ethereum and the foundation. And also some news that Trump wants to launch both a Bitcoin and an Ethereum or Ether ETF. I mean, we'll not comment on any Trump actions anymore, so I would just leave it as it is, but definitely another interesting development.
And I've also seen that there are now quite a few companies who try to copy that Bitcoin treasury idea also for Ethereum. I mean, Joe Lubin, the founder of Consensus, I believe, is slowly becoming, I mean, the term that has been used, the Michael Saylor of Ethereum, basically trying to build up something similar as Michael Saylor has done for Strategy. I'm not sure if that works as well for Ethereum as it works for Bitcoin.
And what I've also seen is that there are also more and more companies now building up reserves with other cryptocurrencies. So I'm not focusing on what you said, Alex, basically kind of copying what Michael Saylor is doing. So just doing the one thing, right? So just holding ETH or something else, but companies that have a legitimate business now also aim to build up other reserves. So I've heard about company that wants to do XRP and BNB and all of that, but I have to say this seems to be some kind of outliers. And of course, most of the activity in the hundreds of companies, as I mentioned, is around Bitcoin and investing into Bitcoins.
I'm not sure if we already bragged enough about the alpha that we created on the ETH price over the last months here in this podcast, because I remember when the price was close to 4,000, we started the discussions here that whether ETH is really kind of delivering what it has promised, and that we have the feeling that there are a couple of challenges in the ETH ecosystem that have to be addressed. And then I think pretty much at the bottom, 1,500, 1,600, we made it very official that our stance has changed towards ETH, and that we believe that it might be underpriced at the current price. And this was, I think, like a couple of days before it came back to now 2,400 or 2,500. So there were like 1 or 2 weeks where it increased by 50% or so. So just wanted to use that point here in the podcast to brag a bit about the alpha creating power of the Bitcoin, Fiat and Rock and Roll podcast, while of course I want to mention that none of what we are saying here is investment advice, of course.
And we also have to add the disclaimer, Alex, that our price predictions often were not the best in the past, so it's good to have a little bit of a better track record now.
It's very fair that you mentioned that as well, yeah.
All right, so we already talked a little about the US, but let's go a little bit deeper into the topic of the US. There was a very, very interesting piece of regulation that basically passed the Senate, the Genius Act. Let's disentangle this a little bit further on what happened there and why this matters.
Yes, indeed. The US Senate passed the Genius Act with 68 votes in favor and 30 against on June 17th, the first major stablecoin legislation to clear either chamber in the US after years of regulatory uncertainty in the states, particularly under the SEC. So 18 Democrats joined the Republicans in voting in favor, and this makes it genuinely bipartisan to me. That's relevant because it shows bipartisan recognition that stablecoins are really payment infrastructure and not only mere speculation. Genius here stands for guiding and establishing national innovation for US stablecoins, and the key word here is stablecoins. This is, for me, focused legislation, but not comprehensive crypto market regulation. So it's important to distinguish what Genius actually covers and what it does not cover. It does cover federal licensing for stablecoin issuers through OCC for non-banks and through existing bank regulators for bank subsidiaries. It's a one-to-one reserve backing with high-quality assets like cash and short-term treasuries. It includes or it covers consumer protections, including guaranteed redemption rights and monthly reserve audits. It covers AML compliance with criminal penalties for false reserve reporting, and it covers prohibition on interest payments to keep these as payment instruments, not investment products. So that's what it covers. What it explicitly doesn't cover is Bitcoin, other cryptocurrencies, NFTs, DeFi protocols, crypto exchanges. So it's all about stablecoins. So it's not, it doesn't cover general market structure. All of that, by the way, falls under the Clarity Act, which is completely different legislation. Now, the complication here is that the Genius bill now heads to the House, where Financial Services Chair French Hill wants to combine the Genius Act with the Clarity Act. Trump reportedly opposes combining them, which makes sense to me because they are really different. While Genius is laser focused on stablecoins, the Clarity Act is about market structure and way more comprehensive, and combining both might carry the risk of losing both, or in particular losing the Genius Act.
And I mean, that was kind of the European approach to combine both, right? So in Europe, the MiCA had the background of primarily Libra to go into stablecoins, majority is on stablecoins, but it also regulates the services around that and also kind of covers Bitcoin, right?
I think MiCA at least had the ambition to cover way more than stablecoins, but frankly, in its first version that went live January 1st this year, it predominantly does focus on stablecoins too. So you don't find NFT or DeFi regulation in MiCA either.
Yeah, that's true. But you have all the regulation around when you want to become a service provider in the crypto space, you have a separate license which is regulated under MiCA. It's probably somewhere in between, right? Because in Europe, of course, we have other, let's say, market infrastructure acts like the DLT pilot regime. I don't know the Clarity Act in detail, what exactly it would cover. I assume it is broader than MiCA, but I also agree with Jonas. MiCA, and this is sometimes forgotten, is actually more than only stablecoins. And Michi, you said something interesting. You said that to whom does actually the Genius Act apply? And you said it's banks, non-bank qualified institutions and state licensed entities. And the reason why this is interesting is because we had the Wall Street Journal reported that Amazon and Walmart are considering issuing their own stablecoin, which is first, of course, super interesting, and a super interesting idea that now non-bank or non-financial institutions start issuing their own digital currencies. The goal is, of course, to facilitate payments within their ecosystem and potentially reducing the reliance on credit cards, credit card networks, and of course the high costs with which they sometimes come. And now the question is that even possible under the Genius Act? And my understanding is that it is possible, but it comes with a couple of hurdles, right? There, my understanding is if Walmart and Amazon really wanted to do that, and considering them being now non-financial, non-bank institutions, they would need the unanimous approval of three entities, which is the Secretary of the Treasury, the Chair of the Federal Reserve Board, and the Chair of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, so the FDIC. And they would have to follow very strict rules around data use limitations. So what Genius really tries to avoid is that someone like Amazon combines transaction data, payments data with, assuming they have their own stablecoin, with their own stablecoin, and data on their platform, like purchase data, in order to kind of improve targeted advertising to their clients. So my takeaway was, because I found this question really interesting, possible, but it comes with quite a few hurdles for those to make that happen.
And Alex, you already mentioned some players that did react quite close to actually the Genius passing to the House. There were additional market responses, not necessarily because of the Genius pass, but they just coincidentally maybe happened at the same time. That's up to debate. There was Circus IPO, a pretty successful one. We're going to deep dive into it later. Then JP Morgan launched the JPMD tokenized deposits on Coinbase's Base the same day as the Senate voted. And then you already alluded to it. Amazon, Walmart, and DTCC all explore stablecoin issuance themselves. Then under a non-bank license through the OCC. Yeah, so do you have a perspective on whether that was just coincidence that happened almost exactly on the same day, or that there is kind of a strategic US approach that both regulators and private sector organizations proceed that well aligned or orchestrated?
I mean, my feeling is that there is definitely like a causality here, let's say. So, I mean, if we look, for example, Bank of America, they also announced some stablecoin initiatives. They always said, if the regulation is clear, we will do something. And other players like Revolut also announced potential stablecoins, and there have been way more news we discussed, right? So I think everybody was waiting for this moment and they had kind of a feeling, and now the momentum seems to be there. So everybody talks about stablecoins, right? In German banks, you hear that the ones that are not looking into stablecoins currently, then they now look to it due to Trump and Genius. So I think it's a combination, at least from my outside perspective, that most of this was really driven by Genius. And I mean, Circle always wanted to do the IPO when the market momentum was better, right? So they postponed it before. So I think they at least had a rough feeling when this will come.
I think the interesting question is, would they have done the IPO also without Genius approval? And I tend to say yes, because the momentum is just huge anyway around stablecoins. And of course, you usually don't decide, hey, let's do an IPO today. That's a multi-month, potentially even multi-year preparation. So you can, of course, play a bit with the exact date a couple of weeks earlier or later, most likely. So I could imagine that they have taken that into account. And let's say, let's maybe do it after we have the results of Genius, but I assume that Circle would have done its IPO, and also JP Morgan would have launched its JP Morgan coin or deposit token. But of course, it definitely helped that Genius passed.
So beyond explaining what it actually is, so the facts and the news around Genius and what's now going on with it, for example, is it going to be combined with the Clarity Act, I would add a take on why Genius actually matters in general for us, but in particular for the United States. And that is that, for me, the stablecoin regulation projects dollar dominance globally. So the EU Parliament literally calls it now officially in a document, and that's my knowledge by today, crypto mercantilism in a recent study, with 97% of stablecoins already US dollar denominated. To me, Genius systemizes this US dollar advantage through now regulatory clarity. So there is definitely policy ambition to further project dollar dominance globally through stablecoins. And think about what Genius actually does. It creates now systematic demand for US treasuries through the reserve requirements it imposes. It encourages global adoption of dollar-denominated payment rails, and it gives Treasury Secretary the authority to authorize foreign issuers. So every Genius stablecoin transaction reinforces dollar centrality in ways traditional banking never could. And what's also interesting is that the Federal Reserve actually plays a limited role. And to me, that's a feature, not a bug, because by using the OCC for non-bank issuers and state regulators instead of the Fed, the Genius actually avoids the political toxicity with the debate around CBDCs and still achieves similar monetary projection of the US dollar dominance, but now through private markets, through private stablecoins.
Yeah, but, I mean, we have talked about that already in the past, and that's probably the biggest difference between the US and Europe when it comes to the stance against digital money, that the US is very much in favor of stablecoins, while in Europe, of course, in particular, the ECB is rather pushing its digital euro. This is why I was somehow relieved when comparing MiCA and the Genius Act, and I haven't done this now at a super detailed, super high level of detail, but at least kind of the most important building blocks seem to be more or less the same, or at least very similar. And I mean now things like, it's not possible under MiCA to pay interest on stablecoins. It's not possible under the Genius Act to pay interest on stable coins. You need to back the stable coin with high quality liquid assets. You need to be a bank, ideally, or some kind of financial institution if you want to issue the stable coin, or you need to jump a couple of hurdles before you can do it. I think that's even more clear or easier in Europe, because there you just need that e-money license. You need to become an e-money institution. I think in the US there are a bit more flexibility, but at a high level, at least until now, I haven't found that huge difference between those two regulatory frameworks that lead me to saying, oh, well, US dollar stablecoins will become even stronger now, because they are also, from a regulatory point of view, now have huge advantages, or the other way around. But I'm not sure if you, Michi, or Jonas have found any of those differences that might lead to an imbalance between US dollar stablecoins and euro stablecoins.
I think I took a look at this, like the key regulatory differences. So there are differences in my interpretation, but not necessary. I'm not sure whether they lead to imbalances, as you described. I think one difference is who can issue. Actually, in EU's MiCA, only EU credit institutions and e-money institutions can issue, while under the US Genius Act, at least, once it becomes legally binding, it would be banks, non-bank qualified institutions, and state licensed entities. So, I mean, there are differences, at least in how it's described, who can issue a stablecoin. Other differences are then in the actual reserve assets. I think under EU MiCA, it's 30% in bank deposits and the rest in highly liquid instruments. And under the US Genius Act, at least the proposed one, there are more flexible investment options and broader asset classes allowed.
I'm not sure, Michael, how deep you went into the Genius, but do we know more on these assets? Because I think that's the most interesting part, right? So how flexible are you, under which circumstances? Is this primarily government bonds? Because also the US, as we've discussed before, see this as a chance to get higher demand for US Treasury, which I think is pretty smart, right? So do we know more on the reserve requirements? Because again, I think that's one of the crucial parts for a stablecoin.
Yeah, not that deep right now. We're going to have to carefully read through both.
Yeah, so I mean, what I've heard is that it's still basically treasuries, and something as what Tether does at the moment would not be in line with the Genius
Bitcoin
Act. So if you have Bitcoin, for instance. Yeah, and I mean, also going back to who can issue, of course, you have, of course, differences. But I mean, first one is banks, second one is non-qualified institutions. In Europe, it's called credit institutions, which is a bank, and an e-money institution is a non-bank qualified institution. You could also, that's another term for e-money. And then, of course, you have state-licensed entities, which does not exist in MiCA, but I think there we are already then at a point of detail where we say, okay, of course, there are differences, but does this make a complete difference for those two regulatory frameworks? Maybe it does, right? Maybe it really turns out that now Walmart and Amazon and other corporates maybe issue their own stablecoins in the US. I think that's to be seen. But at least at a high level, I was happy to see that it's not that the US dollar stablecoins are allowed to receive interest now, because then we would probably remain at where we are, that 99.5% of all stablecoins are US dollar stablecoins, and the rest who is not allowed to pay interest is kind of sharing the remaining 0.5% market share.
And that's a good way of putting it. So certainly there are differences in the language, in, for example, the treatment of large issuers, which are under EU's MiCA, under strict additional requirements for significant issuers, while Genius tends to opt for a more one-size-fits-all approach, regardless of size. The question for any difference is always, does it alter the level playing field? Is it a competitive advantage for US stablecoin issuers? And at least I have to admit that I cannot come to this conclusion yet, whether it really alters the level playing field or gives competitive advantage to US players or US issuers.
One company who was for sure extremely happy about the Genius Act is, and we have mentioned them already, Circle, since they did a very, very successful IPO. And I believe one reason for that successful IPO was not only the fact that there is now a regulation in the US, but also that it is a regulation that is probably very much in line with the philosophy of how Circle has built its company versus how Tether, the biggest competitor of Circle, decided to build its company and its reserve, because Circle can just continue doing what they have been doing and they will probably fall under the Genius Act, while Tether would not, right? And Circle did its IPO on the 5th of June this year on the New York Stock Exchange. For those who want to invest, the ticker is CRCL. But maybe before you invest and before you put your life savings into the Circle stock, take a closer look at the valuation, because this valuation is pretty crazy. It's around $50 billion, and Jonas has already mentioned that's higher than most of the big banks in Europe. There are not many banks that have a market cap of more than 50 billion in Europe. What's interesting is that the IPO itself did not start with 50 billion market cap, but way lower. And it turns out that this IPO was the seventh largest underpriced IPO since the 1980s.
So what
does underpriced...
Yeah, who made a lot of money here, Alex?
Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of people made a lot of money, but in particular, the people who owned Circle stock before the IPO could have made way more money. That's the meaning of underpriced. So it means that basically the price with which you go live, with which you do the IPO, which was $31 for Circle, is significantly lower than the traded price at the end of the first trading day. And indeed, it was the case that during the first trading day, the price increased from $31 to, I think it even quickly went above or very close to 100. I think the high was like $95, and then end of day, I think it was at $82, $83, so a 167% increase in price during the first day. So why is that a problem? You usually try to avoid such a high increase during the first day. It's always good if the price increases a little bit on the first day, because this shows like, hey, there's some momentum. But 167% means that, of course, if you owned stock before the IPO and you decided to sell equity during the IPO, you have received $31 versus you could have received $82 or $83, right? And this means, just to give you an idea, that for instance, the Circle itself, the company, has collected $434 million by selling shares, but it could have been way more. And then there is a second group who sold shares, like the founders, etc., like Jeremy Allaire, of course, he sold shares during the IPO, and this group collected more than $500 million. So these are basically the two groups that sold shares, right? Circle itself, but then all the people, the investors, the VCs, the founders who already owned shares pre-IPO, they also sold shares. And Circle as a company collected a bit more than $400 million, and all the VCs and the share owners, the equity owners, collected a bit more than $500 million. So in total, they collected close to $1 billion.
But this also means, Alex, on the other side, if you sell this like pre-IPO, and that I understand that Circle and some of the investors basically could be off way better. But on the other hand side, the people or the institutions they sold the shares to, they benefited, right? So weren't this normally like banks or institutional investors? Or who was this?
Exactly. Those are the winners, right? All the investors who were able to get their hands on shares at the IPO price, of course, made an immediate 167% gain on the first day. And now, I mean, they are even up more, right? I mean, the price is now close to 200 or around $200. So if you held your shares, that's, of course, even better. But just coming back to give you one number, I mean, I've just said as Circle, the company, and all the equity owners, they raised around $1 billion by selling shares at $31, but they could have raised almost $2.8 billion. So they left like close to $1.8 billion on the table by kind of underpricing the shares. But Jonas, as you said, of course, those who have bought are now the lucky ones. And of course, most of the Circle employees, for instance, and I'm sure also Jeremy Allaire, are still owning shares of Circle, and there is usually like a 6 month holding period where you are not allowed to sell. So I believe also the Circle employees and the equity owners are still very happy and will hope now that in now 4 months or 5 months, when they're allowed to sell their shares, the price is still at 200 or even higher.
It's really interesting because, of course, all these companies and, you know, the institutions that support IPOs, I mean, they do this, like, I wouldn't say on a daily basis, but for years, decades, right? So that you somehow have such a, you know, let's say, feeling on a valuation that is, I mean, wouldn't say so wrong, right? But in the end, turned out that momentum is definitely very different. This also shows how difficult the market is to predict, right? So, yeah, for me, it was super fascinating that there was such a mismatch in the IPO price and the price we still see now.
And my take is that this IPO simply matters because it's the first major stablecoin issuer to go public. So a big milestone here in June 2025. But to me, the pricing tells two different stories. Of course, the massive underpricing shows that institutional demand or demand in general was way higher than Circle expected, which is a good signal for crypto legitimacy. But trading at 380 times the PE ratio, which you found out, Alex, doesn't that look like bubble territory? So I see kind of a risk here. So Circle makes money to a big extent on treasury yields from USDC reserves. And if competitors now start paying interest on stable coins too, or rate drops, the business model breaks. And they left $1.7 billion on the table in the IPO, as you explained. So that is then really money that they might need when competition now heats up in the post-Genius Act world, when more and more stablecoin issuers join the market under a regulated market environment. So the IPO validates that stablecoins are real business, but this current valuation to me assumes that investors assume the USDC dominance forever, and that's a dangerous bet, I think.
Yeah, there are a couple of people who have kind of built evaluation models and try to justify the valuation, or at least made it transparent what you have to believe in order to justify that valuation. You definitely have to believe in a huge growth of the stablecoin market. You have to believe in Circle at least defending its market share. You have to believe in probably Circle adding additional revenue streams like the Circle payment network, and that even if all these things happen, you also would have to believe in a very, very high price earnings multiple. So yeah, I put 318 there, which is at the 2024 earnings, which were only 157 million. And I mean, more than 300x PE ratio is out of this world. I mean, even young startups, they might have 100 or maybe even 200 if they are really young. After you've IPO'd, it's very rare to see this kind of multiple. But I mean, of course, these valuations are always forward looking. And as you said, Michael, it definitely shows that the investors are very bullish about the future of stablecoins, which is probably a bit a reflection of, and Jonas, you have said in the beginning, a reflection of the market momentum. So I think Circle couldn't have found a better time to IPO and use that fear of missing out at the moment. First time you're able to invest into a stablecoin issuer. So yeah, kudos to Circle. There are a couple of other small stablecoin news that we can do quickly. We wanted to mention, since Tony McLoughlin was here and guest in this podcast a couple of weeks ago, it was episode 348, Ubix, so the stablecoin startup that Tony McLoughlin has founded, has now done a funding round. They have closed a 10 million seed funding round led by Galaxy Ventures. Just as a reminder, Ubix is a startup that is focused on building a global stablecoin clearing system, so very much complementary to things that Circle does. So Circle is the issuer and Ubix wants to be the clearing network. The round had quite some prominent investors. Coinbase Ventures, for instance, participated, the Founders Fund, VanEck, and also Paxos, and others. So congratulations to Tony and the Ubix team for making that happen. They also did something which I find very smart. They created immediately a partner network. So I assumed you just had to sign an MOU or something similar to become a partner of Ubix. So they are already starting with a couple of names, including stablecoin issuers and companies like Paxos, Ripple, also Allunity is part of that. That's, of course, exactly what you need as Ubix, right? If you want to be a stablecoin clearing system, you need to build a network as quickly as possible and as big as possible. So it was good that Tony and the Ubix team were able to immediately get out there with a list of partners. And of course, if you want to know more about Ubix, please listen to the episode 348 of this podcast. And then last but not least, Stripe did another acquisition. After having invested or acquired Bridge, Stripe has now acquired a Privy. I'm not sure if it's pronounced Privy or Privy. I've heard both. I will stick to Privy and sorry for potentially mispronouncing that name. Privy is a crypto wallet infrastructure provider. We don't know the price that has been paid, but it's still remarkable that Stripe does now its second, and I assume it was not a small acquisition in a very short amount of time. So maybe just a quick reminder, what is Stripe? Stripe is a payments platform that enables businesses to accept money online. So you can accept payments via credit cards, digital wallets, and now increasingly also stablecoins and other digital assets. And Stripe is one of the global leaders in that space. So they have millions of businesses worldwide that are using them, for instance, in their online shops. How does Privy now fit in there? As said, Privy enables wallet infrastructure for apps or for websites. So you can basically embed a wallet by using Privy on your website, which makes it easy for users in the end and also for developers to then build a nice, smooth user experience, because you don't have to force your users, for instance, to come with a MetaMask wallet and connect MetaMask to your website before being able to make and receive payments. And this is why I believe that Privy is really that an important building block for the Stripe ecosystem that fits together well with Bridge, right? Bridge was that API ecosystem that allowed to connect via APIs to enable stablecoin payments. And now Privy is basically the wallet infrastructure that allows you to receive and store those stablecoins. So makes a lot of sense, that acquisition, and shows that Stripe is really serious about kind of integrating and enabling stablecoin-based payments in their ecosystem.
And it also shows that Stripe really wants to tackle one of the key hurdles for adoption of stablecoins and, blockchain-based payments in general, which is the on- and off-ramping issue, right? Because Stripe does have millions of companies as customers. So they do have the network, the reach, but currently it lacks like an easy to access on off-ramping capability. So I think this is just a very smart strategic move, Alex, and fits, as you said, very well with the acquisition of Bridge just a few months ago. So I think this shows that there is, all this news shows that there is a lot of momentum in these topics, and also that there is really a lot of very high M&A venture building wave currently going on. I remember, Alex, you did like a hypothesis for some of the years for a lot of acquisitions in the space. I think this was not this year, but the year before, right? So, but we are there now.
Yeah, I'm usually 1 year late also with my ex-payment stuff. So yeah, I'm losing a lot of beers because I'm always late with my predictions. Or I'm early with my predictions. It's late that they become a reality.
Too optimistic, but at least they come reality. So
yeah. But I mean, Jonas, you made a good point, right? There are a lot of stable coins being issued at the moment. So the question is, do we need 100 stable coins or 1,000 stable coins going forward? I used to be pretty clear always and thought, well, that it's an oligopoly. Usually you have exactly what we see currently in the US, that we have 2, 3, max 4 big stable coins, and the rest is, they have a long tail of very many very small stable coins. I still would say there is a higher probability that this will still be the case in the future, that there's a very small amount of successful stable coins and a very large amount of very small stable coins. That being said, I mean, with now things like Ubix, a clearing system, and with corporates starting to consider issuing their stablecoins, of course, if we create a possibility to make it very easy to on-off ramp into various stablecoins and then also clear stablecoins, make it very easy to switch in between stablecoins. You could, of course, also imagine a world where there are hundreds or even thousands of stablecoins, so everyone issuing its own currency, basically, or its own digital form of money. And due to these middle layers that make the swapping in between and the trading and the exchange super easy, for us as end users, it doesn't even matter. And for us, we don't even distinguish between different stablecoins. We just see euro or US dollar, and in the background, all the magic happens. So I think the probability that the future will look like this has, for me at least, increased over the last months with all those infrastructure pieces that have been built and developed.
Yeah, that's certainly one requirement that has to be kept in mind throughout the evolution of stablecoins, that is the UX frictions. And having too many stablecoins to be managed by users might be such a UX friction. By the way, that brings me back to Stripe acquiring Privy, which is exactly about eliminating one of these user experience frictions. And with Stripe, even at scale, because Stripe already processes payments for millions of businesses, and now they can offer embedded crypto wallets without forcing users through the MetaMask setup hell that, yeah, at least some users experience it like a setup hell. And in the same vein, I argue for the evolution and the coexistence of many, if not too many, stablecoins. So I frequently hear the question, yet another stablecoin? A stablecoin for either crypto, the highly regulated financial economy environment, or now increasingly for the real economy with SAP's digital currency hub effort, with Amazon and Walmart considering them. So my worry is that it may cause another user experience friction. On the one hand, the choice out of many stablecoins, and then their usage in different realms, be them for crypto, unregulated crypto markets, let's simply say crypto markets, be it for the regulated financial economy or the real world economy. So yeah, ideally we'd have one global stablecoin or two to have some competition, which only from a UX perspective would be optimal, yeah, because you don't have to manage the big set.
I mean, what I would really hope, and this comes very close to what Alex just said, that in the end, that we just don't see what's in the bag, that this is a stablecoin, right? So similar to the internet today, we're all using it for all applications, but we are not seeing what happens in the background, right? So my hope is really that the services become so good that in the end, you don't really see what's behind there, and it's just good. It works, it's quick, it's cheap, so why not using it, right? And it doesn't really matter what is behind. It's a blockchain or not, or AI, I don't care. I want to just make an easy, quick payment globally. So that's the hope I'm really having. Again, I think these infrastructure pieces now seem to come together also alongside regulation that is there. So I'm hopeful there. But of course, also from a corporate perspective, I do understand that currently everybody wants to do a stablecoin because A, the business model is really good in times of high interest rates. You see with Circle IPO how successful this could be, right? So I think there is also a hype dimension in there. And let's really see if we revisit this, I don't know, in 5 years. Let's see how this develops. But I would really vote for a future, Alex, that you described, that there are maybe many around, maybe not 100, but, you know, a few. And then there is a clearing system or something that makes this very smooth, very easy to use, because I'm always thinking this from the perspective of the user. And I think just here it really adds value.
I would even go as far as saying that if we want huge and significant adoption of stablecoins as a means of payment in traditional finance or the real economy, it's the only way to make it happen in a way that it doesn't matter whether it's stablecoin A versus stablecoin B. So very similar that we do not distinguish between a JP Morgan US dollar and a Goldman Sachs US dollar today. It has to be the same for stablecoin. So me as an end user, as a retail user, or even a corporate user, I don't want to distinguish between different stablecoins. I just want to use the US dollar. And I might even not want to distinguish between whether it's a stablecoin or a deposit, meaning which rails are used, whether it's on-chain or off-chain. So ideally, I just use the US dollar in the future. And then depending on my exact use case, the rails are chosen, right? And that is kind of my vision, or one potential vision for banks in the future. And this is also why I believe that stablecoin issuers are probably sooner or later becoming banks, or the other way around, banks are going to issue stablecoins, because then you just have a menu of potential ways to make payments, which can be on-chain, which can be off-chain, which can be a deposit, which can be a stablecoin. And you just pick the right one depending on what your client needs at that point in time and for that very use case.
Yeah, Alex, here I would add one nuance in that. Yes, I agree with you. Money in movement, so for settling a transaction, users must not care about which stablecoin is being used at the moment for settling whatever transaction or payment. But for money in rest, particular my money in my wallet, I do care about which stablecoin I hold, because treasury requirements or reserve requirements differ. And you certainly want to reduce counterparty risk, losing your money because of improper reserve management.
That's a fair point. And I mean, what we also see, Alex, and this adds a little bit more complexity that I hope in the background we are not seeing in a few more years, is that the lines get more and more blurred between stablecoins and tokenized deposits. So here we had a very interesting move, namely that JP Morgan basically announced and also launched already its own token, JPMD. So the smart contract has already been deployed. And that's very interesting, because JPMD is a US dollar deposit token launched on Coinbase's base, so Ethereum layer 2. So this means, in short, that now also a JP Morgan deposit token is available on a permissionless infrastructure, which is the first of its kind, because in the past, stablecoins were on permissionless infrastructures and tokenized deposits were probably in 90-95% of the time around permission setup. And this is, I think, was also a very, very interesting news this month, that JP Morgan, as one of the largest banks globally now, also extends its services, let's say, to a permissionless infrastructure here on Base.
And I think that has always been their plan, right? I mean, when I was still at Deutsche Bank, of course, we had regular exchange with JP Morgan back in those days. So it's probably like 3, 4, 5 years ago. When they, of course, were very much focused on their permissioned ecosystem, they had their own permissioned blockchain. But already back then, they said, look, our vision is always, we understand, of course, that the permissionless world is interesting, and this is where the most of the business and the activities are happening at the moment. So I think it was always their plan to open up at some point in time. And I think that's a first step to open up, right? There's always, of course, regulation. You always will have to permission it to some extent as a bank. You need to know who holds your deposit token, just from a regulatory point of view. But putting that permission token on a permissionless blockchain is, I think, a very interesting first step, and potentially, of course, makes this token available to more and more interesting use cases.
And again, I think this is a very important move. And I agree, Alex, that JP Morgan always had this master plan, let's say, from very early on, or at least developed over the past few years, that currently JP Morgan has $3.9 trillion in assets. It settles approximately $10 billion a day. It's one of the largest non-Chinese, or it is the largest non-Chinese bank globally. So JP Morgan is really one of the leaders in terms of size globally. Even Kinexys, so basically the kind of separate entity within JP Morgan who does all this and has the platform and also issued the token, settles already today $2 billion in volume. This shows this is really already happening. Of course, this $2 billion is not on the permissionless infrastructure. It's just a limited pilot, right? But it shows that this is something a lot happened under the surface here, but that this is really a very large player, obviously, that is going into this permissionless world. And I could imagine that this now also wakes up a lot of banks who were always wanted to go into permissioned infrastructures. If JP Morgan and Kinexys is now doing this, I mean, we will see if I will be right. But I think that could change something on this whole discussion between permissionless and permission that we also had in this podcast probably for the last 3 years or so.
So Jonas, how would you compare now the deposit token from JP Morgan with the stablecoins we've just discussed?
Yeah, great question. So I was always not the biggest fan of deposit tokens, because it was about permissioned infrastructures, and basically until this token. I think this changes now a little. So I would say advantages compared to stablecoins is that they are basically operating under existing banking regulations. So you don't need new regulation like now Genius, or in some countries we don't have stablecoin regulation, so you don't need to another regulatory piece. Another advantage is that it's basically fractionally reserved. You could also say this is a disadvantage, so I don't want to judge here.
Advantage for whom is the question, right? Advantage for JP Morgan, exactly. For sure, that it's fractionally reserved for the user.
Exactly, for the bank it's good, but for customers like Michael who take care and want to know what's in the reserve, and that is, you know, this is highly liquid assets, that of course, that's a difference. So that's one point. Another one is it can potentially be interest bearing. So we heard about Genius and Mica that stablecoins or e-money tokens, how we call it here, are not allowed to pay interest. Of course, from a business perspective for a bank, this is again a very positive thing. And the last one, as far as I understand, this would also fall if you are in a country where you have deposit insurance. This also falls below deposit insurance. So long story short, there are a lot of reasons for companies why this is a better use case, business case, I mean, than existing stablecoins. So this is kind of the positive side, if you will, primarily from an issuer perspective or a bank.
So Jonas, would you say that the following distinction is fair? So the JPMD is tokenized deposits. It can pay interest. It's limited to bank customers and it operates under banking regulations, while Genius stablecoins cannot pay interest. They are transferable to anyone or fungible, and they operate under payment regulations, that is Genius.
So I would say that this is a pretty good summary, Michael. I mean, one caveat I would make is currently that the JP Morgan coin here, or JPMC, is currently only available for customers by JP Morgan. So it's basically a coin within their ecosystem, which is B2B focused. So there are use cases like settlement of JP Morgan customers and entities globally about cross-border payments. So think about, you send money like, you know, from JP Morgan entities in Europe to Asia to a customer in the US, basically kind of instantly in a T plus zero settlement. So that's kind of the use case. So it's a different use case that we currently see for open stable coins. So this means to date, Michael, I would say yes, it's only for the JP Morgan customers, because there's also a fungibility point here. Alex said this before, right? There is different assets and risks in the balance sheet of a bank. But I mean, maybe in the future, there will be ways to also, settle and get these deposit tokens for broader reach and not just for own customers. So to basically solve this fungibility problem. But that's definitely, I think, a little further down the road.
Yeah, and that's the biggest challenge. And it's definitely not easy to solve. I mean, the way we have solved it today off-chain with the deposits is by having a clearing and settlement system via the central bank. So at the end of the day, usually the central bank then settles all the outstanding balances between banks. And we would have to build something similar, in my opinion, because you cannot send a JP Morgan deposit, whether it's tokenized or not, to, let's say, Citibank. So Citibank will not accept a JP Morgan deposit. What happens is that, of course, you can send money from JP Morgan to Citibank. That, of course, works. But what's actually happening in the background is, of course, that there is central bank money transferred between the JP Morgan account and the Citibank account. And Citibank will only credit you your money as a receiver as soon after it has received the central bank money via its central bank account. And that's a problem that does not disappear after we have tokenized deposits. It's still a liability of JP Morgan. And if you send this liability of JP Morgan to a Citi bank customer, the bank will not accept that. And if you're not a customer of JP Morgan, you cannot directly receive the JP Morgan deposit token, because you need to be a client in order to do that. And that's a very, very difficult problem to solve. You basically have to rebuild that clearing and settlement system. And there are a couple of projects that do that, that try to do that. We are talking about them on a regular basis here. Project Agora from the BIS is one example. I think, as you said, Jonas, I think that's couple of years, probably many years out, and this is why I'm a strong believer in stablecoins for now, because that's the solution, that's life, and that's working. But in the long run, I've said that before, I expect those solutions to get closer together and maybe merge into one in the end.
Yeah, so this fungibility drawback is really a hard nut to crack. So even if you might have thought after all the advantages I mentioned, wow, you know, this is so much better than stablecoins. I mean, at least maybe from an issuer perspective, This is really a drawback, which really limits it today that it can be used kind of in a distributed setup that everybody can participate. And this is also one reason why this token has been set up in a permission form. So as I mentioned, this is currently just available for JP Morgan clients and their clients off, right? So this is very important. So this is not pure DeFi or anything. We don't see that. And also a drawback I wanted to mention, however, this also holds for stablecoins currently. So it holds for both. It's like these basic committee on banking supervision requirements, which is typically the capital requirements, that everything that you put on a permissionless blockchain, you have to put a lot of equity. I mean, to put it very plainly, like a kind of back this with a lot of equity in order to be allowed to do this from a like regulatory perspective. And this challenge doesn't go away if you use a tokenized deposit, because it's still based on a permissionless infrastructure. I'm not a big fan of these requirements. We discussed this before, but as of today, we have them, and they both hold for everything that is based on a permissionless DLT, I would say. All right, so you see, a lot has happened around stablecoins, tokenized deposits. Again, I'm always often really, I think it's really crazy if you zoom out what's happening here with all the numbers. So I often have to ground myself to zoom out. But maybe to round up this episode, let's come, let's kind of conclude and come to our knowledge bites that we brought for our audience today. So maybe Alex, you want to start? What did you bring for our listeners today?
Yeah, I plan to bring something, but then I thought that someone has already gave me a knowledge bite. So I'm just gonna take that. I'm not sure who it was. Maybe it was also myself.
It was you, too. You told me to edit. So.
Okay, so you edited exactly. After I told you. Okay, thanks for reminding me. I mean, it's a very good knowledge bite. Jonas, we have written an article about Bitcoin reserves, and it's probably now it feels a bit like an old topic. Bitcoin reserves, hasn't that been discussed over the last months to a sufficient degree? But we did something slightly different, because we asked the question, when and under which circumstances does it actually make sense to include Bitcoin in a strategic reserve? And then we came up with a taxonomy of strategic reserves. I think that was inspired by an episode here that you did with Jürgen Schaaf from the ECB. And we said, well, there are different forms of strategic reserves. It can be the traditional strategic reserves in the sense of I need food and I need certain commodities in times of crisis, like oil, etc., up to maybe something like a sovereign wealth fund can also be interpreted as some form of reserve. And we had like, I think, four types of reserves in total. And we said, well, for this one, Bitcoin might be a good fit. And for that, it is not. So try to bring that discussion, let's say, to the next level, because there usually isn't really made a distinction between those different types of reserve when we discuss Bitcoin reserve and whether it makes sense or not. This article has been published in Börsenzeitung in German, but also Jonas and I, we put it on our websites in English, and we are happy to share all those links in the show notes.
Nice one. Looking forward to reading that one. I brought a knowledge bite that is close to the Genius Act, which is being taken very serious by the European Parliament, that brought it to request a dedicated study by academics labeled Crypto Mercantilism versus Monetary Sovereignty, dealing with the challenge of US stablecoins for the EU. So you might go as far as saying Europe is afraid of US dollar stablecoins, but at least we in Europe take it serious. And the key insight of that very study is that the EU Parliament now officially labels US stablecoins strategy as crypto mercantilism. That is, it's weaponizing dollar stablecoins for global monetary dominance. And we've talked about that, particularly with John Helge Egilson in a previous episode here at Bitcoin, Fiat and Rock'n'Roll. You're going to find it in the show note. Yeah, the bottom line of the paper is the EU has declared stablecoin regulatory war, if you will. It's positioning MiCA as a shield against American monetary imperialism. And the most precious asset of this very study is that it does provide the detailed comparison of the proposed Genius Act in the States and our active MiCA regulation. It's a very comprehensive appendix with a table that has a very nice comparison. Enjoy reading. How about you, Jonas?
Yeah, thanks, Michael. I also brought a paper that is related to stablecoins in Europe, namely a paper that we drafted at the Digital Euro Association, or our working group drafted that, which is called The Role of Stablecoins in European Financial Sovereignty. Because, I mean, we wrote this paper because we have the feeling often from a strategic perspective that the EU is currently not getting all the strings together when it comes to what stablecoins mean for sovereignty. And the US, I think, has is of course, as we discussed before, approaching this from a different angle. And what we basically want to do, and this is very sophisticated, so I think 30, 40 pages, to provide a taxonomy what digital and financial sovereignty means and how stablecoins can contribute there positively and negatively. So this really tries to be a very objective piece on what this means. In this regard, we also introduce a new taxonomy on stablecoins, like depending on where they are based and which currency and where the legal entity is, etc. So I can also definitely highly recommend it, even if I'm a little bit biased that I'm sharing this one, of course, due to my role at the Digital Euro Association.
Excellent. Thank you, Jonas, for your knowledge bite. And thank you, listeners, for listening to Bitcoin, Fiat, and Rock and Roll, to making it to the end of today's episode. Thanks, Jonas and Alex, for your takes today and your insights. Do connect with us on YouTube, LinkedIn, and our expert community on Telegram in both German and English available. Visit our website for more detailed analysis and detailed show notes. And make sure to subscribe to Bitcoin, Fiat, and Rock and Roll wherever you get your podcasts. And join us next week when we'll be exploring another critical development in the evolution of digital finance. Until then, this is Bitcoin, Fiat, and Rock and Roll, bringing Europe's perspective on digital currencies to the world. Thanks for listening.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
The views expressed are solely the personal opinions of the hosts and are provided for informational purposes only. This podcast does not offer financial or investment advice. Always conduct your own research and make well-informed decisions before investing. Please be aware that the hosts and guests may hold cryptocurrencies or digital assets discussed in this episode.